Welcome to the Belfast Men's Health Group with Dr. Angela Atella, a consultant in sleep and respiratory medicine in the Belfast Trust. So today, Angela is going to tell us a wee bit about her job. But before we get involved in what sort of sleep apnea is, Angela, just tell us a wee bit about yourself. What got you into medicine, I suppose?
Well, so thanks for having me on. At the moment, I'm one of two sleep consultants based at the Belfast Trust. And I work with a brilliant team of sleep physiologists and a brilliant nurse and some very patient sleep admin support staff who keep us right. But in my spare time, when I'm not doing that, I am a mum to two boys, Daniel, age nearly seven, and Joel, age five, and a wife to a husband, Chris, who's a journalist. And I suppose they're my backup team to what I do. And as to what got me into medicine is an excellent question, one that I wonder about all the time, really. I suppose it's a really good mix of things that I really enjoy. So there's a bit of science in there, there's a bit of communication in there. It's a lot about having good relational skills and being able to explain things in a way that is appropriate to the person in front of you. And having a good relationship with them really forms the basis of a good patient-doctor relationship, which sounds terribly old-fashioned, but really it all comes down to that. So those are some of the things that maybe keep me in medicine. As to whether or not they made me go into medicine in the first place, I'm not really sure.
Were you good at school? Were you good at science?
Not actually. I wasn't naturally good at science. So I was actually much better at languages and English, particularly in the arts. But I decided for some reason I wanted to be a doctor. And so I decided that I had to get good at the sciences. And with what some might say is my usual brand of stubbornness, I basically had to work really hard at it. Didn't come naturally to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so you're in medicine. And what sort of got you into sleep or the sleep apnea?
Well, I've been a consultant in sleep since 2013. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I suppose I'm dreadfully biased, but it really is the most interesting subspecialty that anyone could do. It's absolutely fascinating, in part because the biggest part of what we do is obstructive sleep apnea, which is treatable. So the fact that it is something that we can treat, the fact that it is common, and the fact that we can bring about, in most patients, an improvement in some really very disabling symptoms of sleepiness and fatigue and so on, that is just so enormously rewarding. And even, you know, the guts of 10 years down the line, I'm still really, I find that so rewarding when patients come back and they've been able to persevere and they feel better. But the sort of significant minority of our work is about sleepwalking and narcolepsy. And this is a different patient group who really deserve a lot of care and thought. And our narcolepsy population is small but growing. And these patients deserve our very best. They're going to need lifelong treatment and support. And it's a group I feel very sort of strongly about and we're learning a lot about.
Mm-hmm. So I guess you've answered a lot of the questions, but what is sleep apnea? What is...
So the guts of what we do is obstructive sleep apnea, which is the commonest kind of sleep apnea. And it is a very, very common condition that is related to the breathing tube up in the neck or the upper airway, narrowing and closing recurrently when we're sleeping. So if you think of the breathing tube or the upper airway as being just a muscular tube, or I like to think of it as, you know, the paper straws that McDonald's used to use and still use. Yeah. And they get soggy when you put them in your milkshake.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what happens to the upper airway when you go to sleep. It's just made out of muscle and it relaxes like all the muscles in the body. In obstructive sleep apnea, that happens recurrently through the night. So narrowing, closing, you wake up, even though you won't remember it, and the breathing tube opens. Narrow, closed, you wake up. The breathing tube opens. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it stands to reason. People feel unrefreshed by sleep. The sleep is broken. Mm-hmm. There are some pauses in their breathing if there's a bed partner there to hear it. And really, it makes life very, very difficult. I like to think, again, in a biased way, that sleep is like the common denominator for life. If you don't sleep well, life is really hard. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something we can all recognize and identify with, so much so when actually you're having breathing dips and oxygen dips and recurrent arousals from sleep. So that's the bulk of our work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the talk about being physically fit, the talk about mental fitness, and we're going to talk about that. But a very, very important part is sleep. So without sleep, without a proper night's sleep, it affects your whole health and well-being.
That's right. And it's so interesting because it's something that we all do. People always have an opinion on it. So, and actually, because it's something we all do from birth to death, it's something that people have quite fixed beliefs about, which is it actually adds an extra dimension of interest and often challenge to what we do, because people will say, oh no, this is not that because of sleep apnea, it's because of this and this. Mm-hmm. And actually that's quite interesting. So we have to sort of be able to incorporate what we're doing and take account of people's fixed, occasionally not entirely correct views about their sleep.
Mm-hmm. So I think you've touched on it a wee bit. Sleep apnea or obstructive sleep apnea, is it preventable or is it curable?
So it's not directly curable. If you think of, in terms of thinking of obstructive sleep apnea as the product of a linear set of things, it's actually the combination of lots of different things that maybe don't work as well as they used to. So it's more common as we get older.
Mm-hmm.
It's more common in men. It's more common as we gain weight, particularly mm-hmm. where we gain that weight, but as we gain weight. And it's more common in those of us who have a breathing tube or upper airway, which is what we sometimes call unfavorable. So if you have a jaw that's slightly set back, or if you have an upper airway or the bit at the back of the throat, which is very crowded, for example, by tonsils, but not just by tonsils, particularly in adults, it can be other soft tissue there that can crowd that area. The combination of all of those things can come together and cause obstructive sleep apnea. And it doesn't happen, just happen overnight. It comes on over a period of years. And that means the symptoms are insidious. They come on very gradually. Mm-hmm. And often it's patients, family or partner or even colleagues or bosses that notice it. Mm-hmm. Other things, alcohol will make it worse. Sedating medications, so sleeping tablets will make it worse. Other medications that have a side effect of being sedating will make it worse.
Mm. And then sort of leading on from that, what's the patient journey, if you want?
Well, patients most often come to us through their GPs.
Right.
So we would take patients directly from their GPs if they're in our area, and we see some of the other stuff I mentioned would come to us as a regional referral from anywhere in the province. Mm. But typically it's a patient who sees their GP occasionally because of an unrelated thing that the GP realises could be related. And then they come to us, they have a sleep study, which is something that's done in their own home, and then they see us in the clinic with the results. And it's at that point that we can then discuss with them and explore what are the lifestyle factors that can be modified, if there are any, and then what kind of treatment, if any, is appropriate for them.
And what's the difference? Because my wife snores. Is there a difference between sort of...
She doesn't say the same about you, though?
Well, I do snore as well, but and I often say, I think you need to go and see. I know a doctor. I think you need to go and see her. But is there a difference?
Yeah, snoring and... So snoring at the moment is not considered a disease, and it's hard to imagine a scenario when we do consider it to be a disease. There's no question it's a great pest for bed partners and neighbours. But if there are pauses in the breathing, mm-hmm. and that's the critical bit, and the patient is sleepy by day, and that is very difficult, because if you don't get enough sleep, you're going to be sleepy by day. Mm. Or if you drink 10 cups of tea a day, you're going to be sleepy by day. So if you don't sleep well for any other reason, for example, you've got pain somewhere in your body, you're going to be sleepy by day. So part of our job is teasing out all of those other factors and saying, for the sleep that this person has had and that they get, are there symptoms in keeping with that, or are there symptoms out of proportion with that? And then marrying that up with the sleep study results. Mm. So to answer your question directly, if there are pauses and if they are unrefreshed by sleep, if they're sleepy, if they're inappropriately sleepy for the sleep that they get.
No, I think that she's fairly well awake during the day. So, right, okay. Right, so it's not sleep apnea then. Right, moving on then. Treatments, what treatments are there for?
Probably the most popular treatment that we would offer automatically, really, for someone with moderate, so medium or severe mm-hmm. obstructive sleep apnea, syndrome is something called CPAP therapy. So CPAP therapy is a brilliant device. Again, full transparency, I'm completely biased. It was devised in the early 1980s by an Australian man who basically used a vacuum cleaner device, I think, and reversed it because he recognised that the upper airway was narrowing and closing and that there should be a non-invasive way to fix it before they would have done tracheostomy, which is making a hole in the front of the throat. Mm-hmm. And it was obviously hazardous, invasive, couldn't be easily reversed, and you know, didn't always work, actually. So he devised a mask interface and attached it to a machine that blowed air. And that is all CPAP does. So it stands for continuous positive airway pressure, CPAP, and it just blows air, takes air from the room, and blows it into the breathing tube to blow it open. So remember our McDonald's straw, our soggy McDonald's straw, you blow through it and it opens up the breathing tube and it holds it open. It doesn't deliver any additional oxygen. In the most part, most of our patients don't need it. It doesn't deliver drugs. There are no needles. So it's kind of a great treatment. The sticking point is that you have to get used to sleeping with some kind of mask interface on your face. And that's where it's tricky. And so really, paradoxically, it depends on how sleepy you are. If you're so sleepy, if you're very, very sleepy, you're more likely, in fact, to tolerate it because you're that sleepy and you'll be able to have it on your face. So that's a big area of sort of expertise amongst my colleagues in the laboratory as to selecting an appropriate mask, supporting patients while they get used to it, teaching the patient how to use the machine and maintain the machine and, you know, when it's okay to leave it off and that kind of thing.
Because you've answered my next question, which is like success rate or how do patients cope and how do they find it?
I think I would refer back to the stubbornness. What I always say to patients is, can you be stubborn? And if the answer is yes, then by and large, they're okay. But everybody is so different that there are other treatments, but that is the most commonly used treatment for moderate or severe obstructive sleep apnea at present.
Okay, Angela, I think now we've covered sleep to a degree, now very briefly. But moving on to you, you mentioned at the top of the podcast that you're a mommy, you've two sons, and how do you balance, or how do you get that life-work balance between work and family, and I suppose time for yourself to look after your own health and well-being? How do you, or what do you do?
I think the idea that there can be balance in all of that is, you know, it's just a fantasy. There is no balance. I'm stretched beyond beyond really what is sensible with work on its own. And family, it's very hard, I think, and I'm sure people, mums and dads listening to this, or anyone listening to this may recognise that it often feels like you just do nothing well and you do lots of things less than you would want to. So there is no balance. It's a constant plate spinning and acknowledging that at times a plate gets very, very wobbly and at risk of breaking. Often it feels like that plate is me. So what do? I try to preserve family time. Family time is just so important. So especially meal times, dinner times, family dinner times are really important. Quality family time on the weekend is really important. I've started coming into work much earlier so that I can leave a bit earlier so that I can help my sons with their homework better, because that's just one small thing that I could do to kind of claw back a bit of autonomy to do something positive for them. But that puts pressure on in other ways. So I have a very supportive and capable husband, thank goodness. And it's a team effort. But yeah, I mean, I think the idea of a balance between work and life is it's kind of a bit of a joke, to be honest. In terms of other things I enjoy, I love music. Very much. I love jazz music. I love all music. I love being with my friends. I have a great church family. I'm an active member of a church. I'm a trustee at my church, and that's a really good denominator for me in terms of my life. That's a big constant for me in terms of keeping me going straight, hopefully mostly, and picking me up when it slightly begins to fall apart. So that's really important for me as well.
Very good. And you talked about music and jazz music. Do you play any musical instruments?
No, I don't. I'm a I'm an enthusiastic appreciator. But I would love one day to learn how to play. I love the trumpet. Mm-hmm. So one day I kind of, part of me is like, it's got three buttons. How hard can it be? But I know it's really hard because I would have watched a lot of live trumpet players and mm-hmm. In my younger years. And yeah, love jazz music, but really any music I think is... It's the stuff of magic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is. It's absolutely brilliant. But I just came to that because you talked about languages, and I thought, I don't know, I put two to two together and come up, maybe we're five. Anybody who can speak languages can maybe learn to play a musical instrument.
Well, let's hope so. Ask me when I'm retired, yeah. And I'll let you know.
Okay, we're nearly finished, Angela, and here we go. This is what makes you happy? And I think we've maybe answered it a wee bit there, but...
I love seeing my kids getting along well, looking mm-hmm. after each other, mm-hmm. Because it makes me think I've probably done something right. Mm-hmm. I love peace and quiet. I love being in nature. So it's such a cliche, but this time of year is my favourite. I love going on walks near where I live, walking by trees and bushes, and then walking by them again and seeing that things are beginning to happen, that they're growing, that they're sprouting. I love going for walks, listening to an audiobook is one of the ways that I really mm-hmm. manage a bit of me time. So it's a bit of the ultimate multitasking, walking and listening at the same time. But that's good. I used to love reading, but I can't do that anymore.
Yeah. No, I do. I think that getting out into nature is absolutely, I love it myself. And park run, I spirited about park run this morning, but I do love the park run. And there are park walks every Saturday, 9:30.
For those of us with dirty knees,
you can walk. I think it's a great. It ticks all the boxes of physical activity, getting to see your friends. And I guess you've got it in the church. That's essentially
yes,
what it is.
Yes, yep. I mean it's a family, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's creating family.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the last question. I'll tell you what, time has flown past. And you're not allowed to say you're in your dream job. So, what is your dream job? Or if I could chuck you £1 million, what would you do with it?
I wouldn't stop working. I'd like to think I wouldn't stop working.
Yep.
But I'd like to think I might work in a job that had an office with windows. So that would be really good for me.
Oh, wow.
So it would be components of what I'm doing now, but without mm-hmm. the overwhelming and suffocating stress and anxiety and being utterly overstretched. So I do love my job, but I love my job because I think the people in it, staff and patients, are brilliant. And mm-hmm. I really enjoy that part of it, and I love the moment where you're explaining something to somebody and it clicks, or you're talking to somebody about some kind of lifestyle modification and they recognize that actually they can make some kind of change, and that I mm-hmm. find that so encouraging. That's so encouraging. And I think sleep medicine really is the most interesting thing in the entire world. So that I would keep those bits, but as for, I mean, I think working through the pandemic's taken a chunk out of a lot of us that I don't think that will recover for a lot of us. And that's very hard. So probably an alternate reality where I get to do some of that stuff, have a bit of an outside life, a bit more time, a bit more sleep, and an office with a window.
I didn't even touch on it. During the pandemic, so this is the last question now, because you've prompted me on to another question, was during COVID, you were redeployed, Angela?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I was working with all, so I'm respiratory, so therefore I was working on the COVID wards, mm-hmm. Doing sort of chunks at a time of COVID triage and care, frontline care. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, we were based mostly out of the Marsh Hospital, mm-hmm. which is now where all our inpatients are now for us. And it was a difficult time.
Yeah.
You know, there's no getting away from it. But, I suppose the big worry, not to end on a negative note, but, you know, we looked at Italy. I mean, there can't have been anyone who didn't look at the pictures from Italy and the doctors and nurses and the healthcare workers who were dying there. Mm. They were dying and worrying that that was going to happen here. And, you know, we didn't see the same pictures here. I mean, it was dreadful and heartbreaking for mm-hmm. families and relatives and friends who lost people. And you know, that's not going away. That's going to leave a stain and a burden on the province that won't go away. But we didn't see the same loss of healthcare workers as we'd seen elsewhere. Mm. I don't know entirely why we didn't. We had more time to be ready, but I think that's quite a difficult thing when you know that you and your colleagues are all looking around at each other wondering if one of us is going to succumb. Mm. And that's hard. Mm. We did lose some staff, and that's desperate. It's desperate. Yeah. But fortunately, we're coming out the other side, and
yep.
Long may that continue.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Hopefully it's in the rearview mirror now, but... thanks very much. I mean, you're a great referrer into the service that I work in, which is smoking. Absolutely, you're one of the top referrers in. So
I thought you said I was the top referrer.
Well, we're getting more now. there's a few now. You know,
I've got competition.
You've got a bit of competition.
Okay.
And thanks very much for joining the Belfast Men's Health Group in our podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.